I'm James St. James. This is Night Fever, celebrating New York nightlife legends of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond. I am joined, as always, by my co-host, the co-founders of World of Wonder, Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato. It's good to see you both.
Hello.
Adorable to see you.
Good, good, good. Our guest today is a superstar DJ. He is a singer, songwriter, performer. He is a party promoter extraordinaire. He is an OC original club kid. We're going to talk about that. He was there at the very beginning. He is a raconteur, a fashionable man about town. He had a label called Zhuzhi. Oh my God. He had a fashion label called Zhuzhi. We'll talk about that. Welcome to the show, longtime friend of WOW, Larry T. How are you?
Ah, it's so great to be here. I'm great. How are you?
I'm very good. I was just saying the last time I saw you was probably about 5 years ago when you were in Los Angeles, and come to find out that you've been living here and you haven't seen me at all. What's going on with that? What's going on?
Well, you know, I haven't been living there most of the year. I just came for the winter last year to kind of snoop it out because, you know, Swifty Lazar passed away about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I just thought there must be an opening for a Swifty Lazar in Los
at
Angeles.
Me, so, I am the one with
No.
But you've been in Berlin most of the time. You've been in Berlin for what, about 15 years? How long has it been, do you think?
No, I've been in Berlin for 7 years now. And before that, I was 6 years in London.
Larry, people say that Berlin is like the oldest village in the 80s. Is that remotely true?
Oh, it's totally like that. One of the reasons why I really loved it when I kept coming here is because I kind of felt like that kind of, you know, just a little bit on the edge and the kind of the freedom. It was so cheap also to be here that people that are creative, which, you know, I love creative people. That's my passion. And it was in a place where you didn't have to work so hard to survive. So you could actually make music and make clothes and make art. And I was like,
the few times I've been to Berlin, every time I go, I just say, first of all, it's the hottest guys on the planet. It's the best music, the best clubs. There's just that there is the feeling and the energy in the buildings, then everything, all the construction going up, everything about it just feels like such a new city, doesn't it? Like, just it's like this is the capital of the world.
Yeah, you know, I'm a shameless energy buzz seeker, and it just has the vibe. You know, it's funny, when I was living in London, I kept saying, oh my God, in my dream life, I would live between Berlin and LA because I love the vibe of what was happening in LA. You know, there's a lot of my talents could be put to work out there. And of course, if you say anything long enough, the universe will just go
sure.
And chuck you out. So it literally just, I had a wild hair 7 years ago that I would move here and move Zhuzhi here because it was just easier to do here. And I'm more, it, you know, London's so expensive that it just felt, you know, it felt like stress to actually try to do a fashion company.
London is the same as New York, you know, or Tokyo or whatever. Listen, before we get too far into this, I want to play a little game with you.
Okay.
At the top of the show, I mentioned that you were one of the OC original club kids. So we're putting 60 seconds on the clock, and you have to name 25 original tunnel kids, ourselves not included. You have 60 seconds. Go!
Okay. RuPaul, Aphrodita.
Uh-huh.
James St. James. Is that not an original?
No. Ourselves not included. Ourselves not included.
Oh, okay. Oh God, Jesus. Wallpaper.
No. Second generation, third generation.
Oh, original.
Tunnel Club Kids.
Tunnel Club Kids. Oh my God.
I would accept Really Denise, Jenny Go Getter. Is this giving you any?
I was thinking of Really Denise, but Jenny. Okay, Jenny. Now that you said it, Jenny Go Getter, Kiyoki.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really hard to remember.
Okay, I would accept Otto, Oliver Twist, Floyd, keep going.
Floyd, yeah. You know, it's funny, if I could look down my Celebrity Club invites, you know, I could see who was at that particular party, but a couple of them you would disqualify anyway, James, I know, like Diane Brill or John Sex. Or...
Not going to do it.
What about Michael Ehrlich? Wouldn't you have him?
Michael Ehrlich.
Julie Jules, come on, Larry. This should be easy.
Are we allowed to say that name?
Yes, of course. Now, but this should be easy for you. I would also accept Armin Ross, Sebastian, Michael Tron, Magenta. Yeah. Keep it going, Larry. Okay. Keep it going.
I love it. Lizette, because they would constantly come down. God, who did we have? Lahoma Van Zandt.
Okay. The Fashion Patrol, perhaps. Maybe Alice in Wonderland. Maybe Jim.
We had Christina. Christina was our guest once.
Christina, Tony Senecal.
Yeah, Tony Senecal. Yeah, I would have seen her there.
Uh-huh. Leviathan, Black Beauty. Any of these people?
Never heard of any of them.
Reuben Sandwich, Fuchsia Doll, Harlequin.
Yes. No, yeah, you have taken me down to a totally different world that... Yeah. Now, all of them were great. They were all characters, which I love that they were all unique, individual characters.
What this is telling me is that you are not living in the past and you do not think of these people on a daily basis. And it's a little hard for you to recall the 80s. Is that what's happening in your old age?
Well, you know, it's funny. They are recycling that whole era so thoroughly with these new books, like Wallpapers books. And there's a Michael Economy book and there's a Linda Simpson book.
Cover book. Boy, Larry T, Project X, second issue. You were a big star back then. You were huge. They didn't get bigger than Larry and Lahoma.
They sure didn't. Yeah, well, you know, we were the king and queen of Manhattan at one point before we gave the crown over to you and RuPaul.
Yeah, I was with Cody Ravioli. Cody and I were king and queen. Oh. And Ru was with, I can't remember who Ru was with.
Oh, Sister Dimension.
Sister Dimension, yes. Let's go back further than that, though. We'll get back to the Celebrity Club in a second, but let's talk about Atlanta, and let's talk about the Atlanta in the 80s, the club scene. You were part of a whole crew. Let's talk about that.
Well, you know, we were from Atlanta, and Atlanta had a scene going, too. If I remember, I think we got Fenton and Randy down there once to come hang out at the Bonaventure houses that we had. We had two houses in a row.
More than once. We loved coming down there, yeah.
Yeah, how much fun was that? We were going up to the Pyramid Club a lot, so we kind of opened our own Pyramid Club called the Celebrity Club in Atlanta. And, you know, we'd have the Butthole Surfers and the Black Crows. And I had a band called The Fans that I was in. And they had produced the B-52's Rock Lobster's 52 Girls single.
Oh, wow. I love that song.
You know, when I was 18, I dated an unknown Michael Stipe at that point for a short while.
I had forgotten about that. Yes.
I actually think he's the godfather of Electroclash because he also dated Casey Spooner of Fisher Spooner for a couple years.
Wow.
If we had to put all my ex-paramours in one room, we would need like the Staples Center, you know.
Well, how did you meet Michael Stipe? Because it wouldn't have been on Grindr, because that was back in the day, right? This was before Grindr. So.
Okay, well, you know, Michael was like the biggest fan of the group that I was in called The Fans. And they used to play with Blondie, the Talking Heads, all the cool groups at the time. And, you know, one of their singles had been Village Voice Single of the Year. And and they also, you know, like I said, they kind of brought the B-52s and the Brains to New York City. And so, you know, I was the young 18-year-old cutie with a skinny new wave tie playing the organ, the keyboards for The Fans. And Michael Stipe, you know, always being a good talent scout that he is, he spotted me and we just had a mutual interest in indie rock. And I also loved the vibe of Athens. So I would go there on the weekends and hang out and go to after hours parties in basements. And that's how I met the B-52s there. I was such a fan. I didn't know what they were like until when I saw them on Saturday Night Live, literally I convulsed. I was so excited and my life suddenly disco held no meaning whatsoever. After I saw the B-52s, it was over. Disco died the night I saw the B-52s. I was like, oh my God.
And during this time, though, you also had a band in which it was La Homa. And was there like a Lady Miss Claire or something?
Well, that was called the Now Explosion. Yeah, and we had that was the band that went up to New York a lot. And we had, it wound up being like a big drag band where there would be like three drag queens and one drag king.
Deandra Peak or Lurleen, who were some of the other people who were in it?
Well, they weren't in it, but we had a lot of guest stars. RuPaul came up with us to New York for the first time as one of our guest stars and stuff like that. So, and Bunny too. So, they were not actually ever members, but, we all worked together on everything then. We made music together and movies together. And there's even on one of the albums that somebody reissued, there's she already had Harris's on it. The language and the humor that we played with down south, we just learned how to do everything from making movies to making music to DJing to go-go dancing and PR. It was just like a big practice.
Did you also know Nelson at this point? When did you meet Nelson?
Yeah, Nelson would come down.
Nelson Sullivan, of course, a longtime friend of WOW and the videographer of a generation.
Yeah, he's on YouTube at 59th Avenue on YouTube. And we met Rue actually through the American Music Show, because the American Music Show saw our band and Rue didn't know what they wanted to do at that point, but they knew they wanted to be on the TV show, and that Atlanta was so small that that he knew he wanted to hang out with us, because this was insane for cable TV. And the same with Mutual. I mean, when RuPaul showed up, I just remember thinking, thank God, because there was the London music scene where it was like these beautiful big characters and it was gay and it was fabulous, and I remember thinking Atlanta was kind of a one horse town with a bunch of like sad punk rock bands and stuff. But then Rue showed up and I remember just thinking, praise the Lord, finally some real entertainment.
Rue is in something called the Wee Wee Pole, right? So
he had a better band called RuPaul and the U-Hauls.
Oh, right. Okay.
They were like big girls and they danced by, and it was stunning. You really had to see it to believe it. It was so, so wrong and so right in all the right ways. It was so wrong. But
tell me about Young Lady Bunny. What was she like?
Yeah, she was kind of nondescript before she got in to drag. I remember us thinking, she's nice. But boy, when she showed up at my birthday party and announced that her name was Lady Bunny, I remember we all just gagged. But as soon as she opened her mouth, we all knew that it was like the beginning of something big, because she was fully formed from the moment she arrived, from the top of her frosted wig to the bottom of her 80s divorcee high-heeled boot.
There's a very famous story about when you all moved to New York and there was the van that broke down.
We had packed our whole lives into this wobbly van, right? And that we used to tour with the Now Explosion. And me, RuPaul, and La Homa got in the van. And, we were just about sailing over the Tennessee border. And I think somebody had a minuscule little teensy weensy bag of Coke. And so we did what you used to do, is you'd take the straw from McDonald's and we'd give ourselves a little bump. And it was so small. There was not enough to get high. But I remember at the time us thinking, it was like, wow, how exciting. And as soon as we did it, literally the back tire blew out and the van just went plump. And it flipped over a couple times and skid on its side all the way down the along the interstate. And then it went with a big bang. Yeah, much like that. It was like shocking.
Terrifying. I'm terrified just listening. But all the clothes went flying down the street. What happened?
Yeah, all the band equipment was shredded. The wigs, the disco balls, they were all shredded. And I remember just being there like stunned, sitting in the seat once it flipped back over. And Rue kind of nudged me and said, like, hey, doll, maybe we should get out. Because I was clearly in shock. And so we did. We got out and we gathered at La Homa had had all these great photos, these archival photos in this one box. And we could replace the disco ball and the disco wigs and the outfits, but this box was priceless. And there was a big truck coming right towards the box. And La Homa just slid the box right off the street. And so we, most of the things that we really, really couldn't afford to lose are okay. And
well, but then how did you hitchhike to the rest of the way? Did you go back to Atlanta? What happened when you're on the side of the road?
You're going to like this. This is so wrong. We waited around until somebody would be at a shop early enough because it was the middle of the night. And finally they towed the thing to a repair shop. And then we waited around there, so tired, for them to fix it. And then when we got it fixed, I know you're not going to believe this. We drove directly to Jim and Tammy Baker's theme park. Because it was like, that's just what we knew to do. That's what we were like.
And Heritage USA, right? Yeah.
Heritage USA. Oh my God. Rue was wearing like bell bottoms with his hand sewn inserts, like leopard skin inserts and a jacket to match. That was like a green Army Navy jacket with like these splashes of animal fabric down the side. I know you guys remember that look. And we went into Heritage USA, which was like, a religious Club Med. It was all like white people. And RuPaul, you could tell she wasn't feeling this. And and we were all busted. So we rented a room and we slept for like 24 straight hours. And then, we kind of wobbled up the rest of the way in that van with, half the stuff that we brought. So
you get to New York City and immediately you are sort of recruited by Michael and Rudolph to do Celebrity Club at the Tunnel. And this is the birth of the Club Kids. This is the very beginning. 1987 is when it was happening. Tell us about the Celebrity Club and what it was. And give me 25 names of people who went.
Ha! No. No more names.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
But, when we got there, we thought, oh, we're just going to jump in at the Pyramid Club. But it was already kind of over by that time. And Michael had a party at the Tunnel and the connection with Rudolph. And so they offered us a Thursday night? I think so.
Yeah. Or Wednesday. Wednesday or Thursday. I can't remember.
Yeah. In the basement. And it was a dump room. It really wasn't a place where you would put a big party. And so, but they liked the energy that we had. And we made a top 10 list, the top 10 songs of Larry T's Countdown and La Homa and Rue were hosts and Bunny and Christina. And, everybody came in to do little guest slots.
Well, yeah, that was the thing, because it was sort of Michael's way. I remember him thinking at the time he was not getting a lot of attention from the old school. So he would always have a Diane Brill or John Sachs or Larissa or somebody be the guest host of the week. And that was the celebrity of the celebrity clubs.
Yeah. And because we were with Nelson and we live with Nelson, Nelson was Michael Musto's running partner. And Michael Musto also gave Nelson access that he wouldn't normally have had to, Keith Haring's private parties, Andy Warhol's book signing, Stephen Sprouse backstage at Limelight kind of thing. The access that Michael Musto gave him. And then Michael, because, he loved the parties and loved how shameless they were and how naked we got those poor contestants each week. And then just as we'd get them all hot and horny, we'd dump cold water on them. And much to the delight of the crowd, because, what's not to like?
You're telling me that the hot body contest started at Celebrity Club? I thought that was a Disco 2000 thing.
No, we started it there. And it's so wrong that because we were shameless. We didn't, it was a different time. We didn't. And this was, you didn't get canceled then. There weren't all these things you can or can't do. It was a wild time. And these contests were so wrong. People were grabbing the contestants. I'm sure you never grabbed any of those beautiful boys.
No, but I do remember, I very distinctly remember at the Hot Body Contest, that was where we first saw Danny the Wonder Pony. remember, who would give the girls the rides on his, he had a saddle and he would give girls rides on his, he was a pony. Oh. And that was the urine drinker. Remember, he would get up on stage and fill a glass of with urine and then.
Or Dan Dan the Dick Man.
Dan Dan the Dick Man, yeah. Oh, yeah, who's always in like the chiffon wedding veil.
The chiffon thing to get around the nudity law. He would just wear the black chiffon to the ground with sneakers. So then, you know, he could be naked, really. I mean, one time, Tobel, we were at Disco 2000, and my mom was there. And I said, Tobel, can I leave you with my mom for a second? Because I need to run and do some business. I had to do the hot body contest or something, right? And so then, you know, probably an hour. I was probably there an hour. Coming back an hour later, you know how it was at the limelight. And I come back there, and there's my mom sitting with Dan Dan the Dick Man. Who was totally naked, and they were carrying on. And my mother, she was having a great time. She just thought it was a kink. And I just remember thinking, Tobel, because he was kind of hot for my mom.
That is funny. So after Celebrity Club, there was Love Machine at the Underground, and that was your club, La Palace de Beauté. Mm-hmm. That would have been like, what, 90, 89, 80, 88, 89, something like that?
End of 89 and beginning of 90, yeah.
It was a really great party. It was fun.
We later turned it into La Palace de Beauté because Love Machine had become such a magnet for, you know, the Liza Minnelli's and the Tom Hanks and the supermodel trilogy.
Well, I remember when Liza Minnelli came and she ran up to the booth and she played. That's when she played Losing My Mind. And we all lost our minds because she was, you know, dancing in the booth with you. That was so fabulous.
I know. I remember we went to get tickets for the Liza Minnelli Pet Shop Boys.
Well, I was just talking about this yesterday. I went with you to that.
Yeah, no, you were there before us. And when you came out, you were there at the same time picking up tickets. And so, oh, maybe you were there with us. And Liza came by and she said, it says, oh, you boys. She said, oh, Larry or something. And I, you know, it was because I worked the club, but I never would have thought that Liza would know my name. But, and you were like, oh my God, you know Liza. And you made this big fit, which of course I loved, but I really, I didn't really think like, oh yeah, I know Liza.
Well, no, but the funny thing about that is that Liza comes running in and she's in full makeup and full outfit. And she says, Larry, Larry. And she sits down and she's chatting. And then she says, oh, I've got to go do something. And she jumps up and goes on stage, does her number, and then runs straight out like, bye boys. Like she was literally there 10 minutes. She runs in full makeup, says hi to Larry, and then goes on stage. It was absolutely jaw-dropping. It was one of the greatest moments of my life.
It was very funny. I loved it, but I loved it more because of your reaction to her responding to me, which I did not know she would remember, you know.
Well, you went up in my estimation. Like all of a sudden I was like, Larry's really fabulous. I had no idea.
That's what I felt. I felt that.
I do remember a story from Love Machine where one night I was tripping on acid and I'm walking up the stairs and Naomi Campbell, Linda Evangelista, and Christy Turlington are walking down the stairs and they have a camera and I'm all dressed up in, you know, some wacky clown outfit. And they say something about taking a picture. And I was like, oh, you want to take a picture of me? And they said, no, freak, take a picture of us. And they pushed me and I went flying down the stairs because I got it all wrong. They were so mean girl to me. They were just horrible. And we're going to have to cut that out a little bit. We're going to have to edit that a little bit. But they did say, no, freak, take a picture of us.
I love that. Well, you know, they used to, you know, I think they had the hots for Rebecca, who is also an Atlanta girl. She was the stylist with Pat for Sex and the City. And she would dance with like two little strips of tape over her nips. And we swear that, and this is just between you and me, that she had the hots for Linda Evangelista for sure.
Oh, that makes sense. I remember when Rebecca at Red Zone came in on the white horse naked. Remember that? She did the Bianca Jagger thing. That was really. And remember, Frankie was the go-go boy there. My good friend Frankie. Oh, I loved him so much. You had some really good taste in go-go people.
Yes, and they were very friendly too. I'm sure they entertained you kindly behind the scenes too. Maybe, you know, the supermodels, you know, they would come as a cluster. I'd call it a supermodel cluster with Linda, Liz, Christie, and Naomi every week. And they would stand under this light in the basement beside where the dance floor was so that you could really see them, like, clearly that it was the three most famous models of all time. And living in the meat market, they used to shoot all the winter issues of Vogue. So all the time we would run down with cigarettes, and we would feed Linda Evangelista cigarettes. She would never say thank you.
See, they were not nice girls. During this time, you're living with Nelson in that fantastic meatpacking home. It's just one of those legendary houses.
It was three floors, but it was really, really inexpensive because he had been living there so long, and it was right on the edge of the West Village, right across from one of the big fashion photographers' ateliers. It was like during the peak of when they shot Love, What's Love Got to Do With It with Tina Turner at the basketball park, Basketball Diaries. They used the park across the street. A Naughty Girls Need Love Too. I remember we sitting in the window of this three-story townhouse as they were shooting Naughty Girls Need Love Too.
But the interesting thing is it was like a standalone. It was in the middle of a cobblestone square, and it was just a building by itself. It was the safe haven for every drag queen passing through town. It was party central. After Nelson passed away and you guys took over, and it was you and Bunny and the Homa and Boone and Jay, and Rue lived there for a little bit. I loved going there after hours. I know that you probably don't look back on some of that time fondly when we were all, you know, coked out of our minds at 10 o'clock in the morning, but I always felt so safe there. I always enjoyed the feeling of family that permeated that home. It was a really special place.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we're really lucky to have that. But you know, it's funny. I remember when I first moved there, I remember thinking I'd have rather have lived in the East Village, you know, in like a nothing apartment. But yet we had this three-story glorious townhouse with a roof that you could get on top of and a backyard that you could do a barbecue in. And, you know, we just moved up and we were just desperate to try to make something happen in New York. You know, we didn't have any money. We didn't have any, you know, we were lucky that Nelson, you know, took us under his wing, and, you know, and that we, you know, we met so many people through Nelson and Michael and the World of Wonder. I was writing something recently about the love of manifestation.
Law of attraction.
The law of attraction. And I said, you know, that when the World of Wonder sang money, success, fame, glamour, and it was absolutely a mantra that actually took flight, because, you know, whatever you focus on becomes active. And that example came up to me the other day, and I was like, of course, if you sing that song enough times.
Well, I don't know. I've been singing it for 25 years and it hasn't done much for me. So maybe you just have to.
But it was also, I think, the revelation years later is that was money, success, fame, glamour. You know what I mean? It wasn't necessarily the bank account. It was the whole vibology of the place. It was so, it was this sort of, and as you were just saying now, you don't appreciate something till maybe you don't have it. But it was such a sort of ferment of so many creative different people in this self-contained world, I guess, you know?
Yeah, we were lucky that we got to see the New York that we got to see, which was, you know, and I'm not one of those old queens that says New York used to be better than, you know, it's like you hear that and I go, yeah. But you know what? If I had to choose between the parties now and the parties back then and the life that was going on, even though that was out of control and my life just went down the tube, I still would not trade it for what the experiences I got. And once I got sober, you know, I got to do all the things. You know, I thought since all the DJs went on to make $2 million, I had missed the boat. somehow with Frankie Knuckles and David Morales and all that. Because I don't regret the years I spent in a K-hole at Disco 2000 and all the naughty things I did with the poor straight boys that happened to the straight. Well, they weren't straight, really, were they?
No, they were bi-curious, and that's why they were there.
Yes. And so, but I don't regret a bit of that because really ultimately it led me to getting completely sober, which was like, oh my God, the best thing ever could have happened because, you know, I really wasn't able to do as much as I was. I couldn't use my talent while I was so high to the same thing. So getting to get sober and then, you know, by the time I relaunched with Electroclash, you know, the DJ, suddenly Afrojack and Steve Aoki, they're making $30 million a year.
Well, we're jumping ahead a little bit because I'm not allowing that. You're going back a little bit because
reel
I want
it back. I know. You want to reel it back to Michael, don't you?
No, I do want to reel it back to Disco 2000 because that was sort of an iconic period and we haven't really gone through it too much with you. That era of Club Kids when things were getting really out of control. I mean, there's an innocence about the Tunnel era, the Celebrity Club, and Love Machine was about fame and fortune and being fabulous. And then by Disco 2000, things are getting pretty sloppy and messy.
It's funny, when you're in the middle of it, you don't even realize what's going on. But I remember also thinking by the time I got to Disco 2000 that I didn't really know how to take being like the big Roxy DJ to the next level of business, you know, which a lot of people seem to have gotten the human success manual. But at the point, I didn't have a clue, especially high. And so, you know, running the hot body contest, there were some moments like, you know, like when the guy, the hot dude took off his shirt and then took off his pants and then took off his leg.
Yeah, I remember that. Yes. Woody the human stump or something like that. Yeah.
Right. And or we had this one really large woman who one night she got totally naked. And then this little skinny cowboy dude with long hair and a beard and a cowboy hat was hoisted on her shoulders and kind of rode her around the stage. And she almost fell off the stage. Like, honestly, it would have been a catastrophe had she fallen on anyone. And then she kind of got her balance and she lost to Rachel, which was a stripper with like a bionic boob job who won every week practically.
In a world full of straight people, aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
Start your engines and join me in the new mobile game, RuPaul's Drag Race Superstar. May the best superstar win. Available now.
And it was so unfair because, you know, she was like letting it all hang out. She almost lost her life up there. One night I had done a show there and some drag queen lit Christmas lights out of her butt.
Oh yeah. That was Ida Slapter. Yeah.
Ida Slapter. And she also did a champagne enema, right? That she sprayed out at the Disco 2000 heterosexual cute raver boys, and which cleared the room in 2 seconds flat when that spray of champagne came out of her ass. Literally the horror. It was like Carrie.
Lee Bowery did the enema onto the crowd, and it was not a clear champagne enema. It was, and I remember Maurice Brahms had to pay like $10,000 in dry cleaning bills because everyone was sprayed with shit.
Who did it first? Lee Bowery or Ida Slapter?
I'm sure Lee probably did, but it was probably something that was just in the air at the time. Everyone was thinking enemas, enemas, enemas.
Does it matter?
When a trend happens, it happens.
I mean, it just happens, you know.
It should happen.
But yeah, I mean, there were so many really amazing things that are literally. But anyway, after they pulled the lights out of his ass, I ran to the back with that other guy with that was marched around the room with the erect penis all the time. What was his name? Dan, not Dan, the dick man, but He looked like a monster. He talked like this. He was whatever. Anyway, he gave me a bump, and then somebody just pushed me off the stage backwards onto the dance floor. Which literally, I'm lucky I'm still alive. But you know, right. I was so goosed up on K that I just kind of.
When you fall and you're drunk, you're more relaxed and you don't hurt yourself as much. It's the same thing with K. You probably have rubber bones because you're so relaxed.
Well, whatever. Luckily I was unharmed, but there was so much, it was so out of control there. And over the time we saw George Michael gave an unplanned sex show because he got into one of the side rooms of the chapel with some cute boy, and he didn't realize that it had see-through windows on the other side. So he had a mirror on his side, but we had the view of the room of the two of them messing around.
You saw George Michael get it on with some boy?
Yeah, I mean, it was hard to get a look. Literally, everybody in the chapel was straining to watch the show. But poor George, he had no idea because he locked himself in a private room, but didn't realize that, you know, the next room over was rammed with people craning their necks to see a live sex show.
So around this time is when you and Jimmy Harry and Rue write Supermodel. Yes, that would have been what, 90, 91?
91. Yeah, absolutely, 91. You know, we had gone with Rue, me and Lahome and Rue went over to see the Johnny Versace fashion show in Milan, which was, oh my God, it was so fabulous. It was the time where they like threw the supermodels down the runway like confetti. It was like Linda Christie, Naomi, Nadja, you know, it was everybody on that runway. And the supermodels were everywhere around us at the time. And when Rue got his deal with Tommy Boy, I thought to myself, I said, oh, I would really love to get something on a major label. And Tommy Boy was such a cool label. And so I thought, okay, what would it sound like? Well, it'd be sort of new, you know, the new house sound. A house was just, you know, at one point, weirdly, house was like half of the top 10. It was like the Motown era of house music with Show Me Love, you know, a Wiggle It Just a Little Bit. Some of them were legendary and some of them are forgettable. And it was when I was doing the Roxy. And so while I was doing the Roxy and after we had had our experience with the supermodels at the Versace show, I put together a demo that, of a song called Supermodel, which I thought would be perfect because I just thought, I saw Rue as a supermodel. I mean, Rue was always, her proportions were just unbelievable. You know, I remember the first time she did Lady Drag in Atlanta was at a Now Explosion show, and we had a wedding, and literally in her Donna Summer white flowing dress and her big hat, Sunday hat, and heels, literally she stood a foot taller than everybody in the whole wedding party. And it was clear to everyone when she showed up in kind of lady drag that something happened, that it was clear that she was no longer going to be the bridesmaid at any wedding, future wedding shows. She was going to have to be the bride because she was stunning right from the beginning. Just the proportions were just right for lady drag.
So you write Supermodel, everything explodes, and Randy and Fenton do the fabulous video, the music video.
Incredible video. Iconic.
All hell breaks loose.
Work. Legendary. Iconic. Yes.
I was kind of curious. I know I don't want to like ruin James's timeline.
No. I'm being crazy.
But no, it was just so interesting when you were talking before about, I am curious about how this incredible nightclub scene, and you know, you were sort of at the top of it, and yet there was also people were the drugs that were being consumed, which I was like such an outsider to all of that, but like it did seem like on this parallel track, this darkness was happening, and yeah. You were just talking about when you got sober pre-electric, you know, the success of Electroclash. And I'm just wondering, how that moment happened and when that moment happened for you. And if you were sort of what your awareness of the darkness was like, if you know, or if you saw it that way.
When somebody would OD and die, like a doorman, literally everybody would stop for a second and say, so where are we going tonight? At one point, the Gotti guy got caught with distributing the horse tranquilizer. And so suddenly there was no Special K on the scene and people just started dying of heroin because they needed something. It really got dark. And I used to rent my apartment out when I first got sober to drug dealers to distribute bottles of ketamine because I just didn't have any way to make money and I needed to pay my rent. And they would distribute all their bottles and throw me $400 and that would help towards pay my rent. But I mean, it was really a really intense period where, you know, a lot of my friends died on drugs and I knew, you know, luckily, Lahoma Man's aunt, she got sober a year before I did. And she took me to a meeting and I didn't really get the AA thing because it was like a bunch of business people up in Midtown. And I just I wasn't hearing it. And then a year later, you know, I had moved over to a place above a Sound Factory and it was just a total mess of club kids and drug dealers and people would come in and with a gun and rob us all, push us up against the wall. And their disguise would be like a bandage on their nose. You know, it was like no disguise at all. And it was just so dark.
I remember one time with Mavis, I was held up and we'd been partying for about 3 days and there was a knock at the door and it was this kid that we knew, this adorable little kid who I partied with a million times. And I went in the bedroom and all of a sudden I hear screaming and shouting and guns and, you know, and Mavis is crying. And then he walks in the bedroom and he says, oh, hi, James, how are you? And I'm like, hi, honey, how are you? He said, listen, don't come out because we're robbing them right now. So stay safe in the bedroom. But while we tie up Mavis. And then I was like, okay. And like it was one of those things. It was a terrifying robbery, but it was just this boy that I knew and it was fine. So, I mean, I understand how that weird teeter-totter seesaw of terrifying and like not terrifying at the same time.
I can't tell you. I had guns pointed at my head.
Yeah.
It's funny. You know, growing up as a kid, my mother used to read us S.E. Hinton's book, The Outsiders, and that was then and this is now, about gangs in New York City. And I lovingly recreated that in my own apartment.
this is living above Sound Factory. I do imagine that was probably just utter insanity.
Oh my God. For Christmas, I remember we cooked up so much ketamine that we had to use a mashed potato tub to mash it all. Because it was like the holidays and there was going to be just some. I know it's so sad that you weren't there. We thought about you, though.
No, it sounds delightful is what it sounds like. And that's what's so sad is that even now I'm like, ooh.
But really, at the time, I was such an addict that I couldn't even get it to stay in my nose. I remember we'd just like do a mound of it on our hand, like. And it would just like all fall out and we couldn't get high and, you know, we couldn't hardly pee because it fucks up your bladder situation. So, yeah, it was horrible. It was just it got really dark. And you know what? I'm glad it got dark because I've never done drugs once I got sober. I never, you know, had to deal with that story again. And I see people that kind of negotiate with it. And I can't negotiate with it because I'm an addict. So
can you talk about that moment, the turning point for you then? Was there an aha moment or?
Well, you know, around that time, I just remember it for a moment, my electricity got turned off, not because necessarily I didn't have enough money, but maybe just because I just couldn't keep it together enough to even pay my bills. And I knew somewhere in the back of my head that I had talent that needed to be used and that this is not what I had signed up for. Is, you know, I'd signed up for a great time and playing music and writing music and you know, all kinds of things, but this is not what I signed up for. And so, you know, I had to humbly get out of the scene. And, you know, luckily I went to meetings every day. It was at the East Village. But it was a really humbling first year and a half.
What year is this? What are we talking 97? 90? What is this?
Yeah, 97 is when I got sober.
This is after the whole Angel Melendez, Michael Alec thing. You were fucked up throughout all of that.
Yeah. And once La Homa got sober, I knew that it wasn't going to be long until they were looking so good. Their life had come back together again. And so when I went in, I just went in all the way. And it was so exciting because there was lots of celebrities at the meetings because it was New York. And I realized, well, of course, all the kind of creative people that I love to hang out with or that I was hoping to meet being at Disco 2000, but I never met them there. They were all in recovery, all the creators and the music makers and the supermodels. And I met a lot of really amazing people in the meetings. And being where I was, being so humbled at the time, I remember just thinking, oh my God, they were just so cool that.
Well, honey, wait until you get to the meetings in LA because there are some power superstars that will blow you away in the Silver Lake chapter and the WeHo chapter.
You know, I lived last winter in LA and we went to all the meetings over in Silver Lake and they were great. And there were some funny moments where I'll go, familiar. This one looks familiar. Oh, right.
Yeah, lots of grunge 90s rock stars there.
But yes, I'm grateful I got sober. And when y'all guys were shooting Party Monster, which, James, you should be very proud, that was quite an inspiring book. You caught the scene so well in Party Monster. And the movie was just, it has still stood the test of time in its just sheer shamelessness. It won't age. And it's become a fashion go-to for now. Club Kids is just a fashion trope that you go on there and you say, oh yeah, Kelly Green, let's do something in Kelly Green. But I remember at the time World of Wonder, you guys licensed four of my songs, which was so great because Electric Clash was happening. And I remember I was new in recovery still. And when they were trying to get me to do a cameo in the Hot Body Contest. But I knew at the time I didn't want to give up because with the Electro Clash was just going off internationally. It was just so cool. And I just thought, do I want to go back and revisit that dark moment of mine? Or do I want to go and do some gigs in Italy?
Back up a little bit and tell us about the birth of Electro Clash and what Electro Clash was for the people who still might not know about it, for some of our listeners, and the origin story and how you sort of was the catalyst for it.
Well, it's funny. It came from doing Landmark education. I was doing Landmark and they said, you need to do a group project, something that touches, moves and inspires you. And I was about a year and a half clean and nothing touched, moved and inspired me. I thought house music sounded terrible, boring, like it had not changed at all. And so I went to art galleries and I was like, no. I started making t-shirts thinking maybe I could do it. And I said, no, I'm not Johnny Versace. But at the time, I went to see a Fisher Spooner show at an art gallery. And I remember just thinking, whoa, this is the future of something. And then I went to the Jewish Center to see Peaches perform uptown, which was fabulous. Sure. And I looked over and I said, oh, is that Chloe Sevigny? And I knew something was happening because if you see Chloe Sevigny somewhere, you're on the right track, right? And then I went to a party in Williamsburg and it was like Williamsburg was like you couldn't get a cab driver to go to Williamsburg. And at the time, and I remember going to this thing and I was like, oh, I was really uncomfortable because it was just out of my comfort zone. Williamsburg, yuck, what was that? And I went in there and it was just filled with all these hipsters. Like they were, and they were so sexy. Everybody looked really cute. And I was like, oh, that's where they are, is out in Brooklyn. So it wasn't long after that I started doing my parties over in Brooklyn and then decided to do the Electric Clash Festival as a project for my Landmark. Because I needed to do a group project. So, I got Peaches and Chicks on Speed. I'd been in a band I developed a band called Dose with two of the sisters of the lead singer of Chicks on Speed. And I remember when they said, oh, our sister's in a band called Chicks on Speed. I remember thinking, that sounds terrible. Being early in recovery, Chicks on Speed. And so I just thought, I don't think so. Once I saw that they were on the cover of the Face magazine, I was like, oh, well, maybe we have to give these guys a listen. And it was like love at first sight. These, you know, they were just screaming slogans and yelling out the names of bankers and companies that were ripping us off. And I just remember thinking, wow, this is it. And I came up with the name Electroclash and thinking that the people at the Landmark, all the, because it's like groups of 100 or so, I thought, oh, they're going to hate this. I said, my name of the thing is Electroclash. It's like pop music, but using electronic music, pop, but with electronic music background kind of thing. And they loved the idea. They all wanted to come to my festival. And so, you know, by doing it there, I, you know, they kind of gave me coaching on how to get my life back in order and to do get my business back in order. And by the time, you know, we did the festival, I had one of the writers from The Face and Dazed and Confused living in my loft. So the minute it went on, it was immediately distributed into the veins of the music and writing industry. So it was just instantly an overnight sensation. And the word Electroclash just suddenly became, was on the cover of Rolling Stone and what's the other one at the other magazine? Spin. Yes.
It was such a great Larry T moment because I do feel like it was so much of what you, it was the branding, it was, you know, your career in music. It was sort of everything that was.
It all coalesced. It all came together very well.
Yeah. And it's like a historic part of the musical landscape. You know what I mean? It's legacy work now.
Yeah, definitely.
I especially loved it too, because I felt that electronic music had always gotten short shrift. You know, it was always seen as not really rock and roll, not really pop music, just sort of fake imitation. So all that sort of stuff in the early, the very beginning of the 80s, that, you know, Depeche Mode and Yaz, and, you know, it just felt like that had been passed over too soon. And you really came back to it, but stripped it down and made it so good, just like irresistible. And I remember the music supervisor on Party Monster saying to us, you can't use Electroclash because it isn't true to the time of the Club Kids. And we were like, no, but it is the essence of the Club Kids. Do you know? It just felt so authentic.
I thought that was brilliant. Yeah, I mean, if you'd have used techno, it wouldn't have read. But Electroclash had a quality that would translate. It sounded like it had something that sounded like from the past, but it also had something that made it feel really new. And for Party Monster, it made more sense than doing techno, because techno is just it's like white noise. It's not really something that you can remember or that you can work with as music. It's more, so yeah, I thought it was a brilliant idea when, teaming up Felix the House Cat with Money, Success, Fame, and Glamour. And it was like, which is basically, that version was basically, what was it? Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Of course, Bill Coleman was the genius behind sharing those ideas as it continues to be.
Peace Biscuit.
I love Bill.
The idea of celebrity DJ in the 80s, it was you, it was Keoki, it was Anita Sarko, it was Johnny Dynell, and the whole idea of being famous for being a DJ as a persona as opposed to just the beats, you know, because you had Frankie Knuckles, you had Larry Levan, you had Dave DiPino and Dave, you know, Morales, but you guys took it to a whole new level. And then in the late 90s and early 2000s, you talk a little bit about billionaire DJ culture. I mean, Steve Aoki and you know,
Applejack.
Yeah, Calvin Harris, Dave Guetta, Deadmau5.
Armin van Helden.
Yeah. And how they really did, they took it into a place where they're selling out arenas and making, $10 million and everything like that. How do you see yourself as the godfather of all of that?
You know, it's funny, when I bombed out of Clubland the first time, I thought, oh, I blew it. You know, I was the big DJ at the Roxy, and then I just blew it all. And then when I got sober and, you know, started DJing around, and an electric class kind of cooled. That was when the DJs became kind of rock stars. And it's also when I started putting out my own hits like Licky with Princess Superstar, which was on 52 compilation. It went gold on the Steve Aoki collection, his first collection. And he put Santa Gold rapping on it. And then Chantel, you know, Beyonce's producer, did a new version using Chantel. And then you know, Bounce Little Kitty with the Afrojack was another one of the ones that just, it was, again, it just went everywhere. It really was the song that kind of, it was a meow, 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 meow kind of thing that was so catchy and dumb. You know, if you look at my music that I've made over the years, I basically write bitch tracks. And I'm probably the most successful bitch track writers. If you can count You Better Work Bitch as a bitch track, which in a weird way, it kind of could, if the tribal version was certainly a bitch track. You know, that was because it just said work and work, bitch, you know, and some catty cut ups. I still make that. I just had two top 20 songs with one with Justin Vivian Bond called Fashion Queen.
I love Justin Vivian Bond. Oh, my God.
And then Tobel Von Cartier does Black Pussy Surprise. And the surprise is there ain't no pussy. You know, they both went top 20 on Beatport, but these came out right before Beyonce vacuumed up every bitch track. So yeah, I have a bunch of new bitch tracks coming out. And
but I guess what my question was that, do you still feel, I mean, do you feel your legacy? Do you understand what your place in music history? Do you understand your place in Clubland history? When all of the Armin van Helden stuff and Paul Oakenfold, did you feel left out?
Well, no, not when, because I, like I said, I had a couple number one dance records. So it was only then that I realized that I was like, oh, Frankie Knuckles and those, that generation, this new generation is really getting paid. I didn't think that it would go further. I thought that that I'd missed out on the gold rush. And you know what? There came a time after I'd had my hits with Ultra Records and had been doing the DJ circuit for a long time, where I was doing, you know, gigs in Las Vegas, where I had to play the new version of the kind of music I was playing, which was called EDM, except it was like trance or something. It really wasn't something that I could relate to, because I didn't have stars. The stars were really the DJ, and they just flew in some canary to sing on each track. And they were like, you know, just, they were kind of generic. It's kind of like generic music. And I tried to fake it for a while. I thought, oh, I can fake it and get on this money, but I'm a terrible faker. I can't, if I don't love something, I can't sell it. So I did try, but it was horror to have to play for those crowds in Las Vegas. And I couldn't look like, oh my God, we're having a great time. Yes, yes, we're going to play this terrible music. And so I made a choice when I got to London to, you know, make clothes and run clubs there instead of like doing the EDM thing. I just couldn't fake that EDM sound so much.
You couldn't be Paris Hilton in Ibiza.
No, I really couldn't. I mean, you know, if it had been that easy and I could just, somebody could do it all for me, I could do that. But I just couldn't relate to the music. So, and for me, I can't really stay in a club if the music's really bad. I have a hard time hanging out in a club if it's, you know, just generic music.
Larry, what's your take on Michael? I mean, he's someone I think about a lot and has obviously left a huge sort of mark on culture. You know, what your own relationship with him? What's your, you've had the chance, you know, since he's no longer with us, to sort of put it in some kind of context, I guess.
Well, you know what? I don't judge Michael, because I'm an addict and I know where he got with it. And I know what happens to us when we go down the rabbit hole too far. And he was running addictions to both speed and downers at the same time, which I didn't even think was possible, that you could run addictions to both at the same time. And so, I mean, it was lucky that he got thrown in the host job, because he might not have lasted that much longer. I know his heart stopped at one point.
Many, many points. He was always ODing, yes.
Yeah, you know, I can't judge Michael, but, you know, I did a party not so long ago for Scotto and in New York, and people kept saying, oh, Michael's going to show up. You should stick around for Michael. And I couldn't get out there quick enough, not because I want to judge him or not because I hated Michael. It's not a part of my life that I wanted to really revisit or was that curious about, you know? Because I don't regret that I went there, but it just, I my life is just so different, and I didn't really see the point of a photo shoot with me and Michael. So literally I remember walking away on that unnormally warm Halloween night, feeling like, oh, I'm so grateful for my life, that my life isn't that life anymore.
Yeah.
That I got out of there before Michael showed up.
Let's talk about leaving New York when you went to London. What was the decision to leave? And was London inviting to you? Did you have to start all over again?
Well, you know, when I got there, it was the time when, you know, I was DJing mostly in Europe, because I'd had all these hits with Princess Superstar and Afrojack and all that. And so, you know, it was that moment where I just thought also New York had gotten so expensive that the creative crowd that I used to love to see, they couldn't afford to go out. You know, even if they lived in Lenox Hill, they were paying so much money to live there that I couldn't really find where the cool kids were. So at least in London, when I went there, you know, I knew that the people that ran the clubs, and I didn't really know any of the crowds there. But you know, our Super Electric Party Machine party there was the birthplace, the uncredited birthplace of Drag Race UK, because I remember Ahura doing naughty things in the bathroom. I remember Tace. I found some old photos of Tace doing modeling for Gigi. I must have grabbed him and just one night when I was trying to do work and run a club and do the company, which was a lot of stuff to do. I remember trolling the club for models, and there's some pictures of Tace in full white mesh Gigi two-piece suit and charity case and Bimini. I remember the first time Bimini came to the club with Smiley Virus, who was like, and Smiley was the star of the club, and she was like just perfectly pressed, and she had gotten it, she had perfected it, but Bimini was still, she was a little rough at the time, just to put it out there. I mean, she's one of my favorites of the UK franchise, though I am mad about Dakota Schiffer. Every time I see her, my eyes just go, bling, 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 bling. I don't know why. You know, I was a late comer to, while I was in London, I was working so hard with the clothing company and two nights a week that I didn't really watch TV. And I'd seen some of the first season of Drag Race, but I hadn't seen much else until season 9, that I was contacted to try to write some songs for a couple of the songs by one of the guys from Epic or something that was working with you guys. And I was like, oh my God, well, I don't know what it's about. And then when I saw it, I got so hooked that now I've seen everything. I haven't quite gotten to the Philippines yet, but every Italia, España, you know, I have an opinion on, I remember at the time thinking, do these people have any time for a real life if they're talking about these girls on this TV show? And then once I saw the show and saw the quality of the production, I became just absolutely addicted to it, to the point where now, you know, we'll get in Drag Race fights. I'll say, do you really? Really? What are you seeing them? I just don't.
So after London, you go to Berlin. And we sort of talked about that at the beginning, about the Berlin scene and how what a fantastic city it is. And this is where you've met your new boyfriend, Sam.
Yeah, you know, I moved there originally just to make it easier to do Gigi. And that was like when Missy Elliott started wearing our clothes in the videos, and Sean Kingston and MNEK, and you know, it's just suddenly a lot of people, and a lot of rappers, Kid Ink, etc., started wearing Zhuzhi, and so you know, I did some parties there for a while, and then I came to a point where really I just needed to do something different for a moment, and that, well, COVID came and that kind of helped.
Well, that'll do. That changes things. Yeah,
because there were no clubs, there were no shops open to sell Zhuzhi. So you know, I had to totally make a change. And it was during that time that I met, right before it, I'd met Sam, who goes by the name of Morgan Wood.
You said that Sam in drag looks a lot like Lahoma, which is a sort of a callback.
I mean, in and out of drag, they kind of look like Lahoma. I mean,
you have a type then, don't you?
No question. But they're also really, really funny. They're great at stand up. Crowds just really, they're really kind of the big star now in Berlin. And so I never thought that that's where I was headed again, was back into drag, the drag world, and doing, now our thing is we do Icons, which is a festival stage that we're going to be taking around to some festivals next year, you know, because it's for the, you know, there's that territory in culture for, it's what I call the Gaga territory. It's Gays and Girls Alliance.
Yeah,
and it's like we need stages where there's bitch tracks and New York Party House and fun music and fashion shows and dancers and drag queens and so me and Morgan now have a project called Icons where it's Icons International, and we'll take it to some different cities, and it's super great fun.
Larry, it's been absolutely wonderful catching up with you. I miss you. I love you. And when you get to LA, we're going to have to spend some time together. And I would love to come and see this Gays and Girls Alliance.
You'll love it.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
Heavenly to see you again, and always so wise and insightful. And loved, could go on for days hearing all about it.
Great to see you, boys. Glad you're looking so healthy and doing so well out there in that Hollywood.